Shalom, damn it, this is Rabbi Saul Solomon taking you away from the goyishness of this holiday time and bringing you back to Jewishness and joy as we are here on Dave's Gone By. It's 11:30 in the morning on this Saturday, and hopefully if the telephones are working correctly, we have with us a guest. She is an actress. She is a writer. She is also a filmmaker and sounds like a very, very fun person to talk to. And I thought, hey, I like talking to fun people and also people who are creative and write books, because I can't write anything more than like a sentence. And then I get bored and then I need a snack and maybe a nap. But this person has written novels. Her name is Lindy S. Hudis. H-U-D-I-S. She is on, hopefully, the telephone with us as we speak. Lindy Hudis, are you there, and can you hear me? Shalom. Hello? Hello, Lindy Hudis? All right, she can't hear a word I'm saying, so I'm going to have to put her through the speakerphone instead. Hold on one moment. Lindy Hudis, can you hear us?
Yes, I hear you just fine.
Okay, let me get you on your speakerphone. We tried to get you through the board, but of course, this being university radio, nothing works properly. But you sound... How are you doing, Lindy?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Most important question before I ask anything else. Tremendously very important question. Doesn't matter whether it's yes or no, but I need to know.
Okay.
Are you Jewish?
My father was Jewish. God rest his soul. He's passed away. My mother is Southern Baptist. And my maiden name is Sternberger, and I grew up in the buckle of the Tennessee Bible Belt with a last name like Sternberger and a Baptist mom and a Jewish father, so it was an interesting experience.
I can imagine. Well, how were you specifically raised, if anything at all?
Well, with both. I mean, my parents were very generous, and they just said, make your own decision where religion is concerned. And, you know, it was interesting because we celebrated Hanukkah and Christmas, and I'd go to the Jewish Community Center and we'd go to church. So I was exposed to both. So it was a very enlightening experience. So right now I'm spiritual, but not religious.
Spiritual, not religious. And you are married? What is your husband's denomination there?
Well, my husband is the exact same. His father is Jewish and his mother is Catholic. And he calls himself an Oive Maria.
Oh, my God. Save me
so
the jokes.
He's exact as me. He is spiritual, but not religious. So we come from families that are very similar.
Now, I assumed that your husband was not Jewish, very mainly because of his career. He's a stuntman, and I'd never heard of a Jewish stuntman. That's crazy. What does he do? How do you get involved in such a crazy lifestyle thing?
Well, actually, my husband, he just finished working on that TV show called Southland, and he did a stunt. I can't say what the stunt was because that would give away a plot point, and if anybody is fans of the show Southland, I don't want to give away too much.
I don't think anybody listening to this program is a fan of Southland, but I've never even heard of the damn thing, but maybe there are two or three people who are watching it, so don't give it away. But how dangerous was it?
Well, it had to do with cars. His specialty is car stunts. He crashes cars for a living. And my husband was an actor. He was a child actor. He was in a film called The Cowboys with John Wayne.
Oh, my God.
And his character was Charlie Schwartz, the only Jewish cowboy.
I love how these things all sort of circle around and dovetail. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, exactly. And his father is the very distinguished English writer by the name of Norman Hudis, who is a Jewish gentleman. And he was a writer back in England in the 60s. He wrote a very popular English TV series called Carry On, and of course Hollywood Beckoned.
The Carry On series.
Yes, okay. For that, Norman Hudis. That's my father-in-law, and he came out to Hollywood around the late 50s, 60s, and my husband just grew up around the entertainment business, and he just kind of fell into acting, and then he became really interested in stunts, and that's what he does for a living. He crashes cars, he crashes buses. He did a stunt several years ago on a TV series called I Dare You. And you know that stunt where a guy takes a motorcycle and jumps over buses? Well, he reversed it, and he jumped a bus over motorcycles. So he took his bus, and he jumped over motorcycles. And I remember we were engaged at the time, and the pyrotechnics went off a second too soon. And the bus which was filled up with air, just ignited into this big, huge fireball. And I was petrified. I was like, oh, no. But he was okay. So that's what he does for a living. He jumps fiery buses up on ramps. And
oh, who doesn't? Honestly,
yes,
who
exactly,
doesn't?
Exactly, exactly.
Well, but let me ask you, if you have a husband who does this kind of thing, well, mm-hmm. I know he's more safe than 99% of us are in our daily lives. I mean, people go in their cars and they text. They cross without looking both ways. We don't even think if we do stupid things without. He has to be very, very careful in everything he does. And yet, what he does is a little dangerous and crazy. Do you say a novena or whatever the hell you half say before he walks out the door every day?
Always. But the issue with stunts on a movie set or a television set is that the safety issues involved, they're very strict. There's always a medic on set, and they take very good care to make sure the stunt players are safe. So, you know, I do worry about him, but at the same time, I can't tell him, no, you can't do this, because that's what he does. But so that's what I do. I just say a little prayer and keep my fingers crossed, and he's very good at what he does. He's been doing it a long time, but there are a lot of very strict safety regulations on a movie or television set, so that's good.
Has he ever been hurt?
No, I'm knocking on wood right now. No, he hasn't.
I got toy. I'm spitting through my fingers, and which is not a good thing for a radio host to do, because it goes on the microphone and causes an electric shock. See?
Well, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
See, if your husband were doing it, he would show me how to do it without getting water all over the microphone and causing terrible danger to myself. See, that's the difference. There it is.
Exactly.
Now, we've talked about your husband. This is Lindy Udis we're talking. Now let's talk to you. Did you meet your husband when you were an actress? Is that how it worked?
Yes, actually, I did. There is a theater in Burbank, California, called Alani Chapman Theater, but at the time it was called a group repertory theater, and he was directing a play, and I went in to audition for it, and, you know, we just kind of became really good friends and got together doing that. And, he was directing a play, and I just went in. It was one of those 99-seat equity waiver theaters where the actors basically go in to stretch their craft and do theater, and people come in to watch it. And there's not really any pay for the actors. Actually, there's no pay at all.
Of course.
It's just mostly doing theater for the love of doing theater, and that's how I met my husband, was at this theater in Burbank, California.
I have to ask this question. It's a total... No one else will care about this question but me and Dave, who is the host of this program. Was that theater owned by a fellow named Richmond Shepherd? Does that name ring a bell?
No, it was owned by a guy named Lonnie Chapman, who has since passed away.
Oh, and they named the theater after him.
Yeah, the Lonnie Chapman Theater.
Got it. Okay, just checking, just wondering. So, how long ago was this, by the way?
This was in, this was in 2000.
Oh, fairly recently. I thought this was years ago. So, no, not when he passed away, when you met your husband, I mean. This was 2000?
Yeah, when I met my husband, yes. It was in February of 2000.
Oh, Mitmazel, 12 years, congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm a mom of two small children now, so I don't really do the acting thing anymore. I've kind of given up on that and turned my focus onto writing and mom and life, so.
Well, first of all, you've got girls, boys, what do you got?
I have a 5-year-old son.
Is he circumcised?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
Okay, thank God.
And a 10-year-old daughter.
Is she circumcised? No,
she's not.
She's not African. No,
no,
I know.
No, she's not. And Grandma is in the other room right now trying to keep them from bursting into the bedroom and being very, very loud, which they have a tendency to do. They had to explain that Mommy's on the radio today and to please keep your voices down to a reasonable pitch today. So.
That's right. I thank you certainly for that. But before we talk about your current writing life, since we're in the acting sort of game, did you do any movies or just TV? I know you did some theater. What did you do?
Well, I was more like an aspiring actress. I went to NYU. I studied acting at NYU and did some theater there. And then I came out to Los Angeles around 92 to pursue my fortune, and I worked on a soap opera called Sunset Beach. It's not around anymore, but I had a recurring role on that as a nosy TV reporter. And I didn't really do a heck of a lot. I did some commercials, I did some theater, I didn't really do too much, and I turned my focus to writing. And
Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. One thing that you don't mention, at least, it's in your bio, so I've got to ask about this.
Okay.
You did a Married with Children?
I did. That was my first job in Hollywood. I played a bimbo.
All right.
It was my very first job in Hollywood, and they needed girls scantily clad in dresses and high heels and big earrings and big hair to just kind of dance around in a scene. And I didn't have any lines. I was more like a party girl dancing in the scene. But I put that in my bio because it was my first job in Hollywood. And if I ever write my autobiography, I'm going to call it Second Bimbo from the Left, because that was my first acting job in Hollywood.
I hate to tell you, but you may not remember, but I was the fourth bimbo from the Left. I auditioned. They didn't want me at first, but then one other girl dropped out because I broke her ankle. And then they gave me the role.
So you were the one in the red sequin dress and the high heels.
Yeah, now you remember. And the mustache.
Okay, I remember.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You had a boyfriend in a band at the time. He was really cute.
Well, I don't know about that. But anywho. But do you have any memories of doing television, of doing Sunset Beach, or any anecdotes or stories about it?
No, not really anything interesting. You know, the cast of Married with Children were all really nice and friendly, and the people that did Sunset Beach were really nice and really friendly. I remember the day I was there to shoot Sunset Beach, you know, Aaron Spelling produced it, and I was walking around NBC Studios, and I got lost, and I turned a corner, and I am face-to-face with Aaron Spelling's son. I forget his name, but he was very friendly, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm lost, where am I supposed to go? And he said, you're supposed to go so-and-so, so-and-so, but I just remember almost banging right into Aaron Spelling's son.
Actually, that was...
And just being really like, oh, I'm so sorry, but he was very friendly and very nice, so I wish I had some gossip, but I don't really have...
Are you sure that was Aaron Spelling's son? It could have been Tori. She was not an attractive woman.
No, it was the son.
All right,
I don't remember his name, but he was nice. He was friendly. I wish I had more gossip and dirt, but I don't really have any.
Okay, it doesn't have to be gossip, but it could also be like nice memories of famous people that you ran into.
Yeah, nice memories of famous people. I the scene I was in when I did Married with Children, Ted McGinley and Ed O'Neill were in the scene. And they both introduced themselves to us and were incredibly down to earth and very helpful. And I didn't meet any of the other girls. Well, actually, Christina Applegate was in the scene that we were in, and she was friendly and helpful. So it was a positive experience. I wish I had done more. But, you know, I got married and had my kids and decided to focus on writing. I've written a book. I have another book that should be coming out in 2013 called City of Toys.
Yes.
And that is fiction as well as Crashers. It's fiction, but it is inspired by my life as an aspiring actress in Hollywood. But it's a fictionalized, dramatized account of four girls who are all aspiring actresses. And, you know, they're going after their dreams, and sometimes it's not always pleasant, the situations they encounter. And that should be out in 2013. But I have a website, and I'll have all that information on there.
And that book is finished. It's at the publisher, but it hasn't been released yet. You finished that.
Exactly. It's at the publisher. Just hasn't been released.
But the book that is released that people can read now is called Crashers. What is that about?
Crashers. Well, my website is crashersbook.com. And Crashers is a fiction. Again, a fiction inspired by actual events. But it is about a trio of young people who stage car accidents to collect insurance money. And I was inspired to write this book because I myself was a victim of insurance fraud. And I was in a very minor fender bender back in the 90s. And this was a very minor incident. And one of the parties involved decided to sue, saying that they had all these crazy, crazy serious injuries, which, of course, they didn't have. And I was inspired to write this, and in my research, while researching this novel, I realized that according to the Insurance Research Council nationwide, in the United States, there's over 10 million auto, truck, and bus accidents that are reported each year. And usually 1 in 5, that's 20%, are estimated to be of staged or questionable origin. So I was inspired to write Crashers, which is a cautionary tale about the world of auto insurance fraud.
Yeah, no, let me ask about your specific incident in which you, so in other words, they purposely, it isn't like someone has a minor car crash and they think, oh, I better put a brace around my neck so I get insurance money. This is people who actually cause minor crashes in order to start faking it?
Well, no, it was a minor fender bender, and it was an accident where one of the parties it wasn't even an accident, it was like a bump. And basically, I was at a stoplight, and I was going through my purse or something, and I rolled forward, and my bumper bumped the bumper of the car in front of me. And it was just a minor bump. And the girl, of course, calls an ambulance, calls the fire department, made up all these stories, and my insurance adjuster told me that the injuries she was claiming that she had were not consistent with the damage to her bumper, which was non-existent,
right.
And they were making up all these lies, and they were trying to sue, and it was just, you know, it wasn't that this person caused the accident, but it was an issue of fraud, and it made me very angry, and
at first,
you know, I was naive, I thought this kind of thing was an urban legend, I didn't think people really did do
that's absolutely.
And so I researched this,
yes.
People doing this, and it came to the conclusion that people will automatically stage a car accident and claim injuries to collect the insurance money. And my book, again, to reiterate that it is fiction, is about a group of people who are down on their luck, and they decide to try this, and they get mixed up with a crowd of people that are of questionable, you know, they're very shady people, and the well just gets deeper and deeper, and the walls get more and more slippery as they try and get out of this well. So I just discovered, researching this novel, that people do this kind of thing for a living, and it was just baffling to me that they get away with it.
It's pretty, they do, or sometimes get away with it. Your person did not, I assume. Everything was thrown out.
No, this person did not get away with it.
And were they convicted of anything? Did they do any time or have to pay anything for the fraud, or they just didn't collect any insurance money?
You know, I don't know the outcome of what happened to this person. Now, this incident happened in 1995, so I'm not sure if this person did do any time or get arrested or anything. I think they just became greedy. They saw an opportunity. They wanted to get some money. And I think what happened was they just didn't get any money. I don't know if they were arrested. I just think that the upshot was they didn't get any money. They might have seen dollar signs and tried to pull a fast one on the system, which people do. And sometimes they get away with it and sometimes they don't. But I don't believe this person was arrested or anything.
Right. Oh, please. You know, I've tried to collect insurance on the same Torah 4 times. You know, I hold a lighter next to it, there's a little singeing, and then I call up the insurance company, and it's like, oh, there's a page burned, which means we have to do half of the whole Torah over, but they hang up. I try.
Oh, my God. Kind of like the guy who had the cigars that he insured, and when he smoked them all, he tried to collect insurance money on it.
Did that actually happen?
I heard this. There was a guy who had very expensive cigars, and he insured them. And when he smoked them, he tried to collect on the insurance money, and the insurance company said that they can't give him any money because it was theoretically arson.
Oh, very good for them. That's
exactly.
Very clever. Or the, you know, the person who kills his parents and then tries to collect money for being an orphan. You know, that whole sort of thing. But we're talking with Lindy. Is it Lindy S. Udis, or do I just call you Lindy Udis? What's the actual?
You can call me Lindy, but it's Udis. It's pronounced with my husband calls it the Irish U, so it's Hudis. I get Hudis sometimes, but it's Hudis.
Hudis. Oh, I'm glad you have a sense of humor about it. Anywho,
well, thank you.
Let me ask about the first book, that transition from being an actress. Did you start writing short fiction and essays and poems, or did you just go right from, boom, I'm an actress, to I have an idea for a novel, a long-form thing, let me do it?
Okay, I'll tell you about that. My first novel is a book called Weekends, which, you know, Crashers and Weekends are all available on Amazon.com. I also have a collection. I also have an anthology called the S&M Club, which is a collection of erotic short stories.
Woohoo! Don't look for those, yes.
Yeah, it's a collection of bondage short stories. And basically, I always had fantasies about creative writing, and I would always, in my spare time, just write for fun, just as a stress release. And what happened was, many, many years ago, I was sitting in my apartment in Hollywood, and I started writing Weekends, my romance suspense novel. And I wrote the first 22 pages, and just as something to do, just as an artistic outlet, just as a way to relieve stress. And it was written on an old-fashioned typewriter, you know, the kind where you plunk around and you have to have paper and all that.
Oh, yes.
Those old things. And I took the 22 pages and I just shoved them in an envelope and shoved them in a drawer. And then when I married my husband and I moved in with him, I was going through all of my stuff and I found in a box these 22 pages of Weekends that I had written years before. And I looked through it and I read it and I showed it to my husband and I showed it to my father-in-law especially. And I said, well, what do you think? Is there any potential here? My father-in-law, who's English, he's an English writer, he read it and he says, well, you have potential to be a commercial writer.
Is this the guy from the Carry On series? Is
that yes, it's him.
Ah, okay.
It's him. And I, you know, he is a brilliant writer and a brilliant screenwriter, and his giving me advice was all I needed. So I took the I took the 22 pages and I put them on the computer and I thought, what the heck? Might as well finish it. Well, I got pregnant with my daughter. I gave birth to my daughter. And during the time, I was with my daughter at home with her, and when she was taking her nap, I would go to the computer, and I'd just write a couple of pages just for the heck of it, just for something to do while my infant daughter, who's now 10, was sleeping. So every time she'd take a nap, I'd go to the computer and just write for fun, just write for fun, just write for fun. Next thing I knew, I had about 275 pages.
My God.
Mm-hmm.
And then the leap from, well, of course, writing is really rewriting, so then you had to edit and rewrite, and how did that get?
Absolutely.
You all right?
I am. I just got a little coughing fit, sorry. But
it's okay, you're half Jewish. There's always phlegm involved in that, yes.
Exactly. So what I did was I had 200 and something pages, and I put together a little query letter. And I thought, well, what have I got to lose? What have I got to lose? So I took the query letter and I mailed it out to some publishers and agents. And of course, you get the rejection letters, you get the no thanks, you get the get lost, all this kind of stuff. You get the rejection letters, which I still have.
Of course.
And then there was a very, very small publisher who said, send us a manuscript, we'll read it. A small independent publisher. And they were called Whiskey Creek Press. And I said, sure, why not? So I sent them the manuscript, and they offered me a publishing contract, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my gosh. It was like, wow, a publishing contract. I couldn't believe it. So they were the first publisher to publish Weekends. And then from there, I had a bigger publisher get interested in Weekends. So when my contract expired with Whiskey Creek Press, I went on to Legasis, and they are an independent publisher up in Canada.
Okay.
And Betty Young's books published Crashers, and Betty Young is a very dynamic lady. She's in San Diego, and they're both independent publishers, which I like. I like the idea of that because they're very hands-on with their authors. They're more like friends than publishers.
Lovely.
And that's what happened. I just kind of fell into it.
Can I ask, since it's not self-publishing, but at the same time it's not like having Harper Collins or whatever they call themselves these days. So what is the rung of a book? Is it 1,000, 5,000? Are they now able to just do like 200 at a time because of the way publishing is? What's
right
a rung?
Well, it depends. I mean, the smaller, there's good, strong, smaller publishers everywhere. And there's also e-books, e-publishing, which you can sell as a download. For example, my erotic short story anthology is sold as a download, Kindle. People have the Kindle e-book readers. And a lot of people like e-books. I don't know if e-books are going to replace paperback books like people say they're going to, because some people just like to curl up with a good book and not with their with a Kindle. But there are a lot of good smaller publishers out there. I mean, there's the big New York houses, which, you know, are impossible to get published with unless, you know, you're a celebrity or a porn star or, you know, something like that. You know, if you're Tracy Lords and you want to write about what being a porn star is like, then you'll get a New York publisher.
But if you're right,
I got with them because usually they have a a print on demand, which is a technology. The print on demand technology allows publishers to publish books without going broke. For example, when a book is ordered, the book is printed out, which is the print on demand technology. And but with Betty Young's, they did a run of about 2,500. And
nice.
Yeah, and I did a book signing up here. I did a book signing on in several bookstores, and the bookstores carry them. But for the most part, a lot of people are ordering books off of Amazon, and they're also ordering ebooks to go onto their Kindle. And like I said, I don't think ebooks are going to take over paperback, but a lot of people do enjoy that. And the print-on-demand technology is good, too, because it gives authors who wouldn't otherwise have a shot at being published a fair shot, fair shot. And a lot of these smaller publishers do use that technology.
And actually, I have to say, if you're dealing with erotic fiction, Kindles are good for one-handed reading. Much easier than a book.
Yes, they are.
Hold open with two. No, I have to. I've forgotten, or I didn't know about this whole erotic S&M. When the hell did, I mean, are you in that lifestyle? Where did that come from? Or did a publisher say, we'll print it if you write it?
Well, no. One of my publishers, Legacies, does have an erotic division.
Right.
And I used to, this is years and years ago, I worked as a submissive at a house of bondage here in Los Angeles.
Good God. All
and
right.
This was years and years ago. And so.
Wait, do you remember me? I was the guy in the red dress and the mustache.
Yes, you were the one. You were the one.
And, oh, my God.
I didn't work there very long. It was more of just to get the experience. And I don't think it's around anymore. This was years and years ago. And I thought I'd write some short stories that were inspired by when I used to work at a bondage and discipline house as a submissive. And I don't really do that anymore. I'm not really into that lifestyle anymore. It's just, you know, my husband and our kids. And so I just got inspired. You know, little things inspire you to write. So that was one of the things that inspired me.
Good. How long were you working there?
Oh, gosh. Not long at all. Maybe about 6 weeks, a month, 6 weeks.
Was it what you expected?
Well, people, excuse the pun, but everybody was, quote, gentle with me because I was one of the new people.
Okay.
But it wasn't sexual at all. It was mostly guys that and girls that came in and just, a lot of the business, though, were the dominatrixes. Those are the ones that had a lot of the business. And most of the people that came in there just wanted to know what it was like to tie somebody up or spank somebody, and that was me. But I didn't get a lot of the business because I wasn't one of the dominatrixes. They were the ones that people wanted to be dominated, and that wasn't what I was. I was just a sweet, innocent little sub that walked around in my white dress.
Good God. All right. Fine, cool, good. But you had to take this experience, and then, even though it was non-sexual while you were doing it, you had to make it erotic for fiction somehow.
Exactly. You know, you embellish things when you write fiction. You embellish things for dramatic purposes, and that's what I do when I write fiction. I'll take something from my life that's mundane or not quite so mundane or not what people would expect, and I embellish it for dramatic and fictional purposes to entice the reader.
Well, I do that with my sermons. If I feel they're going boring, you know, I'll add two stewardesses and a jar of baby oil. And suddenly, everybody wakes up. They love the sermon. They're wide-eared for 5 minutes. And then I sneak in the biblical stuff. It works.
Oh, good. I think that's a good idea.
So, well, just want to remind everybody that we're talking to Lindy Hudis. Hudis. Mm-hmm. What is your website where people can download your hot, sexy S&M fiction, as well as find out how to buy Crashers and Weekends and all your other writing?
Well, my website is crashersbook.com. And on that website is a link to my Amazon page where you can find out more about Weekends and Crashers and the S&M Club and anything else. But it's crashersbook.com, and it is sold as an ebook and as a paperback.
An ebook and a paperback by Lindy Hudis, H-U-D-I-S. Just a couple of quick more questions for Lindy before we have to let you go. You also shot a short movie. Is that true?
Yes. Many years ago, my husband and I got together and we shot a short film called The Lesson. And
oh my God, is this an erotic S&M short film?
No, it's not. It's not.
Damn
it's more of a morality tale. It's like 11 minutes, and we shot this back in, oh my gosh, 98, 99, and it did the film festival circuit. It showed at the Seattle Underground Film Festival and Cine Nights here in L.A., and I want to download it onto YouTube, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. And it's called The Lesson, and it's about a lady who is very abusive to a young college girl who comes over to her house to clean her house because she's a college girl and she's earning extra money. And it turns out that the college girl's fiancé is the mean lady's boss. So it's a morality tale that you should always be nice to people because you never know. And I should probably go on and download it onto YouTube, but I haven't had the time.
Well, do it. And then, next time your children are sleeping, instead of writing a book, do a little, or download while you're writing, because you hit one button, it starts uploading, and then and you're good. And my other question is, I have to ask, because Dave, who is the host of this radio program, is an alumnus of New York University. And we'd just love to hear some of your memories of going to NYU, being what, in the early 90s?
I graduated in 91. I didn't know Dave went to NYU. Wow, that's amazing.
It was almost a decade before then, but yes.
NYU was fun. I mean, you have to understand, I grew up in Germantown, Tennessee, and all my life I've wanted to go to New York. I wanted to go to New York. I kept saying, I'm going to go to NYU, I'm going to go to New York, I'm going to go to New York. I had posters of New York City all in my room, and I went up to NYU to audition for Tisch School of the Arts as a drama student, and you have to audition before you can get into Tisch.
Right.
And I went in and I did my monologues, and I auditioned for a guy named Ron Argelander, who was one of the deans over there, and he told me right then and there that I got in, and I was like, ah! I mean, I couldn't believe it. I just wanted to scream. And when I went up to New York, everybody would say, I mean, because I had a real thick southern accent at the time, and they were like, oh, where are you from? And I said, Tennessee. And they're like, is it a culture shock coming from Tennessee to New York? And I'm like, you know what? I'm just so happy to be in New York that I didn't even notice. I was like, I'm in New York! Oh! And it's so funny because I know that we have to go, but I want to tell you one more funny story about NYU. I was in Washington Square Park one day, and I had been living in New York for maybe about a month, and I was walking to my classes, and a girl comes up to me. I think she was French or whatever, but she comes up to me and she goes, excuse me, which way is Broadway Street? And I go, I point into the direction of Broadway, and I go, it's right down yonder, down there. And she probably thought I was some bumpkin right off the bus, which I...
You kind of were, actually.
Which I was, Yeah, she was asking me for directions, a kid from Tennessee walking around Washington Square Park. But it was so much fun. New York City is such an amazing place.
Well, it has been an amazing time talking with you, Lindy S. Hudis, or Lindy Hudis, I should say.
Likewise, sir.
And check out her books, Weekends, Crashers, plus the hot bondage fiction, plus all the other stuff that she's writing. It's crashersthebook.com, am I right?
Crashersbook.com.
Lindy Hudis, thank you so much for joining us on this.
I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so if you want to contact me on Facebook, just type in Lindy S. Hudis on Facebook.
L-I-N-D-Y Hudis, H-U-D-I-S, on Facebook and Twitter. Probably still have a MySpace page. For all I know, you have a Wang computer somewhere also.
Probably do.
And an abacus. Anyway, thank you very, very much. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you. And happy holidays, whichever ones you're half sort of celebrating.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Shalom. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.